What if everything you thought you knew about addiction was wrong? Neuroscientist Mark Lewis challenges our fundamental understanding with a provocative thesis. Addiction isn't a disease, it's a developmental process. This perspective turns decades of addiction theory on its head. While the disease model portrays addiction as a chronic brain condition that strikes randomly and permanently alters brain structure, Lewis presents compelling evidence that addiction is actually a very bad habit arising from neuroplasticity. The same brain mechanisms that help us learn languages or musical instruments can trap us in cycles of compulsive behavior, but they can also free us. This isn't just academic debate. The disease model has shaped everything from public policy to insurance coverage, becoming so entrenched that 76% of Americans view addiction as a disease. Yet this framework creates significant problems while benefiting various stakeholders in the addiction treatment industry. Treatment centers profit by promising help without guarantees, while families embrace the model to make sense of loved ones' seemingly inexplicable behaviors. Unlike reptile brains that come mostly prefabricated, human brains require extensive cellular changes throughout life. These changes occur primarily in the cerebral cortex and limbic system, where trillions of synaptic connections form in response to our experiences. This creates a feedback loop. Experiences shape our biology, which then shapes future experiences. When experiences involve strong feelings, especially desire, brain change accelerates dramatically. These changes begin as tentative pathways before becoming entrenched habits. Why do some experiences dominate our minds while others fade? The answer lies in neuronal communication. As Donald Hebb noted, what fires together wires together. Cells that activate each other form stronger connections. This neuroplasticity, the brain's fundamental changeability, is what makes addiction possible, but also what enables recovery. Natalie was a well-adjusted college student who occasionally experimented with drugs without serious consequences until prescription opiates entered her life. These drugs eliminated her social anxiety, but as tolerance built, she switched to heroin for its affordability and potency. Learning to inject heroin marked a critical shift. The ritual itself became addictive. Within a month, her entire existence centered around getting high, with triggers everywhere sparking intense cravings. Though not physically dependent yet, she became psychologically obsessed, constantly planning her next fix and reimagining herself as the raunched-out chick in her personal addiction narrative. During imprisonment, Natalie discovered meditation, ordering numerous mindfulness books that helped her face her chaotic mind and painful feelings. She learned there is a space between craving and doing. When she tried Percocet after release, it triggered dread and disgust connected to her past suffering. Her prefrontal cortex had developed new patterns strong enough to counter striatal impulses, making abstinence itself a habit. What makes addiction so powerful? The brain's striatum, a deep structure evolved to connect actions with goals through desire, becomes hijacked. This motivational core works with the amygdala and orbital frontal cortex to transform motivation into action. In addiction, this normal system hyperfocuses on a single goal. Brian's story illustrates this process. His methamphetamine use began occasionally, but escalated as he couldn't tolerate coming down. Starting with 1 gram weekly, he quickly progressed to 2 grams daily within 2 years, unable to resist that surge of clarity, power, and potential. Even with his daughter Megan's visit approaching, Brian lost control. Despite promising himself restraint, he couldn't resist using more meth and detoured to buy more before seeing her, mentally rehearsing excuses while denying his intentions. The key factor in addiction is delay discounting, or now appeal, valuing immediate rewards over long-term benefits. When rewards seem imminent, the accumbens floods with dopamine, causing us to minimize future consequences. This explains why Brian abandoned his path to his daughter for his dealer's doorstep. Addiction creates a double life, a public self maintaining appearances while a private self pursues the addiction. Donna, a respected hospital worker helping families of sick children, secretly stole pills from friends' medicine cabinets, relatives' drawers, and even from a deceased woman's bathroom during a funeral. Donna grew distant from people in her life, with interactions becoming contrived. This distance suited her, as nobody could understand her attachment to pills. She balanced her compassionate hospital work with her hidden addiction, believing she maintained control by using drugs only after work. This pattern stemmed from childhood with an alcoholic, suicidal father, where she became a caretaker rather than receiving care. Her mother's frequent admonishments, "Don't be dramatic," "Let's keep quiet," taught her self-containment. In adolescence, she channeled this emotional suppression into controlling her eating, earning admiration for her thinness. When she discovered opiates through Vicodin, they offered their true appeal, feeling simultaneously invulnerable and loved from within. Each successful theft brought a thrill of defiance, reinforcing childhood lessons of secrecy. As addiction progresses, neural pathways shift from the ventral striatum driving reward-seeking behavior to the dorsal striatum triggering automatic actions regardless of rewards. This explains Johnny's transformation from enjoying social drinking to mindless consumption in a personal hell, disconnected from reality. Johnny's days followed an identical cycle: waking, immediately gulping rum, then drinking continuously through phases of desperation, brief pleasure, and sedation before passing out. He prayed not to wake up, disgusted by his inability to stop despite watching his life collapse. The prefrontal cortex, our self-control center, gradually disengages from the striatum during addiction. Long-term substance abuse can reduce gray matter volume by up to 20%, explaining why addiction feels uncontrollable. Alice's story of anorexia and binge eating illustrates the paradoxical relationship between control and desire. Though addiction represents loss of control, while anorexia seems to exemplify over-control, both share a fundamental similarity: compulsivity that remains hidden from oneself long after becoming obvious to others. Recovery continues the developmental journey that led to addiction, reconnecting separated brain regions through neural transformation. Michael Chandler's research with Native communities revealed a crucial insight. Humans need coherent life narratives. Communities with high teen suicide rates showed young people couldn't articulate coherent life stories. They existed in an empty present with no sense of past or future. This illuminates addiction's core problem. The narrowing spiral of desire traps people in the tomb of the present, disconnected from their life story. Neurologically, this represents broken communication between the brain's motivational core and the perspective-providing prefrontal cortex. Recovery begins when we reconnect past to present while imagining different futures. Desire must redirect toward goals incompatible with addiction: freedom from suffering, meaningful projects, relationships, and self-coherence. When brain regions that imagine the future synchronize with those driving our goals, addiction becomes merely a developmental stage. Viewing addiction as a difficult chapter rather than a permanent disease offers hope. The same neuroplasticity that facilitated addiction can become the foundation for growth. Your brain isn't permanently broken. It's waiting for you to write the next chapter.